My name is Daisha Clay. I'm the audio librarian here at Classical 91.7. While I'm a real librarian, I have a deep, dark
secret.
I know very little about classical music. I grew up listening to rock, and I know something about jazz. But when it comes to classical, but I really want to learn. So, every week on this show, a classical music expert will give me a piece of classical music they think I should know, and then we'll discuss it. Come learn with me in the classical classroom. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Classical Classroom. I am Daisha Clay, and here with me today from KPFK's studios in Los Angeles is Grammy-nominated mandolinist, mandolinist being a word I have literally never said before now, Avi Avital. He's performed all over the U.S. and the world. He's won many awards, including Germany's Echo Prize for recording with David Orlowski. In addition to classical music, he's also recorded klezmer music, which is very cool. He just released a new CD on Deutsche Grammophon called simply Vivaldi. Avi, welcome to the Classical Classroom.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
What are you going to be teaching me about today?
Well, we're going to learn a lot about the mandolin and hopefully about Vivaldi as well.
I dig it. All right. Tell me about the mandolin. I literally know nothing about it other than that it is a stringed instrument. Like, where does it come from? What are its origins?
It's a good starting point. The mandolin is a string instrument, is a plucked string instrument. And I point this out because a plucked string instrument, if we look at any musical culture, I'm talking ancient musical cultures, there is a plucked string instrument playing the main role. It's the pipa in China, or the koto in Japan, or the tar in Iran, and the oud in Arab music, the bouzouki in Greece, the tamburica in the Balkans, the balalaika in Russia, and so on and so on.
Wow.
So the mandolin comes from essentially the Orient. It travels with a crusade and with a Silk Road and with the merchants to Europe and turns into a classical music instrument. And that happens around 1700 at the Medici court in Italy. The mandolin becomes a very popular instrument and especially in nobility family, in aristocrat family.
Yeah.
It was mostly associated at the time, in the Baroque period, not as a professional classical music instrument, nor a folk instrument or a popular music instrument like people tend to think, but as an educational instrument associated especially with young maidens of this kind of aristocracy.
Huh.
As evidence, we can see a lot of the pictures, a lot of the paintings from the 17th century and the 18th century, of mandolins. We usually see them held by these kind of young maidens, young girls.
Is that why it's such a kind of like small instrument? It's more kind of catered
to women? I guess,
yeah.
I guess it's a very user-friendly instrument, I think, for kids and for everyone. It's, the first contact with the instrument is quite immediate. But that's why a lot of the compositions that were written at that time for the mandolin originally are associated with this kind of scenery. For example, Beethoven wrote for the mandolin. Not a lot of people know that fact.
Oh, wow. I did not know that.
He wrote four little sonatinas for the mandolin, but he never published them because they were love letters. There were little sonatinas that he wrote to a young countess in Prague, in which he was completely, insanely in love. And she was the daughter of one of his sponsors. And she played the mandolin like a well-educated countess. And he writes and dedicates to her these four little sonatas for mandolin and harpsichord, actually for them to play together. The interesting thing is that because it was an amateur instrument, the mandolin part is not very challenging. It's quite easy for a professional mandolin player, while the harpsichord part can get really virtuosic in times, and I think that was his way to impress her.
That is adorable. That is literally the most adorable story I've ever heard about Beethoven. So I don't, like, how many strings does the mandolin have, and what kind, or did they start out as gut strings? Do you still play them with that today?
There are a lot of different kinds of mandolin existing in the Baroque period, like the Venetian mandolin, the Milanese mandolin, the Brescian mandolin, Neapolitan mandolin, and so on. Almost every city in Italy had a variation of the mandolin, and the variations were usually the number of strings and the way it's tuned and the material of which it was made.
Yeah.
Most of the mandolins we see today are the Neapolitan mandolin, are a development of the Neapolitan mandolin. This is, when we say mandolin, this is actually what we mean in our days. And it has 8 strings, but there are 4 double strings, actually. So each string has a couple of strings that is played in unison.
Oh, kind of like a 12-string guitar?
Exactly.
Okay.
And they're tuned in fifth, like the violin. Exactly the tuning of the violin. So E is the highest tone, A, D, and G.
Neat. I did not know any of that. That's so neat. That's what gives the mandolin that unique sort of... It does sound a lot like a 12-string guitar.
Yeah.
I guess that explains it. Well, you know, I noticed when I was kind of reading up about you and your new CD, you referred to the Vivaldi as like Old Testament mandolin. And so I'm wondering what other composers besides Vivaldi have written for mandolin, and what is New Testament mandolin?
So not a lot of composers actually wrote for the mandolin. Not because it was an unpopular instrument, quite the opposite. As I mentioned before, it was extremely popular instrument, but too much associated with kind of an amateur salon environment.
Yeah.
The other composers that wrote for the mandolin in that period is the Neapolitan composer Alessandro and Domenico, also his son Scarlatti. Mozart wrote a beautiful canzonetta in Don Giovanni that includes the mandolin. Hummel wrote a concerto for the mandolin. And that's about it from the famous composers, from the names that we recognize. Then complete silence from composers for pieces for the mandolin for some 200 years, unfortunately. Uh-huh. Like Brahms never wrote for the mandolin. Chopin, Schumann, of course, they did not write for the mandolin because they didn't consider it as a concert instrument. But the renaissance that the mandolin is having right now, I believe, started, I guess, in the second half of the 20th century, where with modern music, composers were seeking new sounds and new possibilities to offer the concert hall. And they found the mandolin kind of a perfect companion to do so, because it was still a familiar sound, yet unused and fresh in the context of classical and contemporary classical music.
Yeah. You know, I'm wondering, one of the questions that I had when I was kind of reading up about the mandolin a little bit is, you know, we've had a classical guitar player on Classical Classroom before, Valerie Hartzell, and she was talking about, you know, the history of the guitar and how it struggled a bit as an instrument, and it's had a resurgence because it kind of doesn't fit in well with symphony orchestra and, you know, composers were writing for symphony orchestras, and so and guitar was more for like a sort of chamber music environment, you know. And has the mandolin had that same issue? I mean, you recorded with the Venice Baroque Orchestra on this CD. Like, how is that?
Yeah, it's very true. I mean, originally the mandolin was a salon instrument. It wasn't designed to fill a concert hall. It was designed to play at home, or maximum to play for friends and family in a salon with nice acoustic. So nothing that could probably fit the big theaters of that time. However, the mandolin as an instrument has developed, and the repertoire has developed. And for example, the mandolin that I'm playing now and that I recorded my album with is a modern instrument that was designed to fit a modern concert hall, and therefore is much louder, has much more sound, and hardly never have to use amplification for it, because it, even if I play with an orchestra, the sounds cuts through, and the volume is high enough to cope with even a larger scale of a string orchestra.
Do you ever just plug the mandolin in with like some distortion and crank it up to 11?
I did that in the past.
Really?
I hope I'll do it in the future. Not in the Vivaldi album necessarily, but yeah, I had a phase, you know, in high school where I played all kind of music and I was playing the electric guitar. And occasionally I would plug in also the mandolin to my distortion pedals.
And then play that one REM song.
Oh my god, of course. That's the best song ever.
Did you just play that over and over again?
Of course, yeah. That's that awesome. That's how I was cool in high school. Play that. You're talking that's about great. Losing my religion with this amazing mandolin intro. It's very iconic mandolin part there. And
yeah.
Of course, every mandolin player learn how to play it.
So who are other mandolin players? I was wondering, like, I know you're like a big advocate for the instrument, and like, do you get together with like the other three virtuoso mandolin players in the world and just...
Definitely, yeah, of course. it's a small community, I guess. Well, the interesting thing about the mandolin is that you find it in different genres of music. So
yeah.
In the United States, for example, it's very much associated with bluegrass, and you have this brilliant mandolin players here in the States like Mike Marshall and Chris Steele, Dave Grishman, and Stateman, who play bluegrass music, but not only. And I'm good friends with them all, and they're brilliant. Brazil, the mandolin, or how they call it in Portuguese, the bandolim, is very much popular in choro music. That is the popular music of Brazil. And there is the most famous figure for this genre is Jacob do Bandolim, who was a famous choro composer and a virtuoso on the mandolin. Nowadays, Hamilton de Holanda is one of the leading figures of the bandolim, and a brilliant jazzist and Brazilian folk music player. And yeah, so it's nice to hear the same sound, the same instrument, playing different genres of music. And
yeah. Tell me about the experience of playing the Vivaldi. Like what when I was listening to your CD, I noticed that a lot of the pieces were at a different sort of speed. They had a little bit of a different sound than I was accustomed. Like, I've heard these a lot of these pieces over and over again, but they sounded very different.
Yeah. I have to say that this is something that I learned from listening to Beatles records. when you listen to a record, like a good rock or pop record, and I'll stick with the Beatles as an example, as an influence for that, every song has different colors. Mm-hmm. In other words, they don't use twice the same drum set in an album. Uh-huh. For every song, they change the sound of the guitars and the drum set and the bass. So they create a whole kind of a sonoric world to each one of the songs. Yeah. And I find it fascinating because you never get tired of a sound. The same sound never repeats twice. And that was the reason that recording the album, I wanted to have that a little bit. I wanted to dedicate to each one of the pieces a slightly different color. That's why, for example, in one of the concerti, I replaced the defaultive harpsichord as a basso continuo instrument with the organ, just to give a rest to the harpsichord sound that you have throughout the CD, and to suddenly have a new sound, which is fresh to the ears at that point when this piece arrives. So that was a little bit the thought about beyond just choosing pieces that are different in character from each other and different tonalities, different characters, but also in the recording process to use the instrumentation and the interpretation to give each one of them a unique sonoric world.
Yeah, I love that. That's really neat. I've never really thought about that, you know, but that's true that like rock and pop albums are often a little more textured, I guess, like in that yeah, you're hearing maybe the same instruments, but they're you know, maybe plugged into an amp with distortion in one song and maybe not in another, so it sounds like a very different instrument.
Exactly.
But on classical albums, a lot of the times it's just kind of the same sound in that way. That's neat. Okay, that explains it. I was listening to it going, hey, wait a minute, I know this one. But it took me, you know, that long to actually recognize it, which is pretty cool.
Oh, I'm happy that you noticed it.
Do you compose for the mandolin, or because I know that, you know, since there's not a lot of music written for it, or not as much perhaps as another instrument, do you do that? Do you arrange other pieces for mandolin?
Yeah, so this is the New Testament we're talking about. and of course, the lack of original repertoire for the mandolin brought me to do a lot of arrangements, like you hear in this album, in my other albums. This is almost my second nature. But also to commission a lot of pieces. So I would go to modern composers and every year, and I would ask them to write for the mandolin. Mm-hmm. And I find it's a very important task. So in 100 years' time, when another mandolin player is interviewing for your radio station, you wouldn't have to say there's not a lot of repertoire written for the mandolin. So I like to do that. I do compose sometimes, although not too much. I have just some pieces.
Cool. This has been so neat. Like I loved the idea of, like, I was excited to get to talk to you because I love learning about things that I know zero about, and this was definitely one of them. I feel like I have about 200% more knowledge about the mandolin now than I had.
Thank you very much.
When we started, Avi Avital, thank you so much for being on the Classical Classroom.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure.
Been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
All right. Take care. All right, everybody, that does it for this episode of Classical Classroom. For more Classroom, go to houstonpublicmedia.org/classroom, or you can go to SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/classroom, where you will find more Classical Classroom than you can shake a stick at. You can also tweet and tumble us, or you can send me a good old-fashioned email at dclay@houstonpublicmedia.org. However you listen to us, be it iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, make sure to rate and review us, because when you don't, we cry. Thanks today to Todd Terrific Holslander for twiddling knobs. Thanks to St. John Flynn for the lovely fruit basket he didn't give me. Thanks to Mark DiClaudio for his piercing coal black eyes. Thanks to me for saying words. And most of all, thanks to you for listening. We'll catch you next time.